But if you have a look at South Africa with the eyes of a rational economist, you'd have to believe that the real focus areas here should be mining and our other natural resource, which is our fauna and flora. In other words, game farming or taking tourists, even better, into appreciating our natural heritage. Well, Colin Bell didn't go into mining, but he certainly has made a huge impact in the whole wilderness area. We're going to find out from him in a moment what put him there.
Michelle's a mom who traded in her Fiat 500 for this beast right here. But why the momentous move, huh?
I needed something bigger to keep up with my growing son in his many sports bags.
When you traded in your car with WeBuyCars, was it an easy conversion?
I see what you did there. The process was just so easy. I was given a tablet, had to sign, and that was it.
Basically, WeBuyCars is no mess, no fuss. Okay, it was nice chatting. WeBuyCars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
Colin, thanks for joining us. I actually had the privilege of staying at one of your resorts, Lekkavater, which is just down the road from where I live in Hermanus. It was our pick. We could afford it because I think you have special rates for South Africans. Thank you for that. And it was phenomenal. It was an absolutely amazing experience. And I wanted to find out who the man was behind this. Now, I do know Adrian Gardner, and he's terribly passionate about the kind of work that you guys do. But I hadn't come across your natural selections. Of course, most people know Wilderness Safaris, which is really where your story almost starts. But it actually begins before then. If I'm correct, you went to university and did an economics degree.
Yep. So I was one of the lucky ones. My dad was a mining engineer, and we spent a lot of our childhood up in the Northwest Cape, and close to the Botswana border. And I graduated. I went to Wits University, and my first lecture was Economics 101. And I said, "Wow, I've committed 3 years of this stuff." And my second lecture was Accounts 101, and I just went into decline. And my third was Law 101, and I was bleak, but you start and you kind of want to continue. And I did a whole lot of, I did geology, I put geography. And then we had a Volkswagen, which made its all its way through Africa. And it had one of those elliptical license plates, which had German number plates on the one side and had the TJ on the other side. And we kind of just traveled as students. We just got up into all these crazy places. We were one of the first people to go into Mozambique once Frelimo had taken over, and we were sort of trying to deal with 14-year-old kids with AK-47s, and we had a surfboard on the top. Oh, my goodness, and a spear gun, and that type of stuff. But we traveled and traveled and traveled, and then 76 arrived, my last year, and obviously that is Soweto riots. And I kind of got the feeling, you know, and people think fees must fall, what terrible years here, but fees must fall compared to Soweto is nothing. It's like a tiddly pups game. And it was very uncomfortable. And I decided, you know, with all the experience we've had traveling around. So I applied for two jobs. One was at the Chamber of Mines in 44 Main Street in Joburg. And the other was the safari company up in Botswana, which happened to have its headquarters also in Main Street. And the one job with the mining company was up in Southwest Africa, Namibia today, with lots of cash, but all in the middle of nowhere and no chicks. And the other job was to work for the safari company in Botswana with no cash and potentially maybe lots of fun and all the rest of it. And I didn't know what to take, and I literally span a coin. And very shortly, I found myself in Botswana, living in the Okavango Delta, and just it was one of those extraordinary things. Even my friends at university, you know, we'd chat and so where are you working? I'm working in the Okavango Delta. And they say, where's the Okavango Delta? And it was one of those absolute fortunate situations. And we quickly saw how a company headquartered in Johannesburg was using a resource in a foreign country and creating no jobs and creating no money, because the money was in South Africa. And the winds of change of tourism were even starting then. And we went to our boss and said, listen, we've got to set up an operation in Botswana. And myself and my partner, Chris McIntyre, probably the best guy ever to work in Africa, one of these extraordinary human beings, funny as hell, but really talented in the wildlife field. And we went to our boss and said, listen, we'll set up our office for you in Maun. We'll employ local people and all the rest of it. And I remember him saying, Botswana's days are gone. It'll never work. And so we gave him an offer. We said, we'll work for 750 Rand a month for 5 years. All you have to do is give us a CPIX increase. And he said, no. And so we said, we have no choice. And we went on our own. And we started Wilderness Safaris with 2,500 Rand each. It was wonderful days. Youngsters going out, fearless, just having fun. And it learned, talking about partnerships. Partnerships, you've got to choose your best partners to go in business with. But it also taught us partnerships of how to work with folks who own the land and control the land, which is basically local communities. Cut a long story short, we ended up operating in 7 countries. But one of the very earliest lessons we had is we started up in Namibia as well. And again, we had no cash, but we had an opportunity to go and do a deal with one of the communities up in the northwest of the country. And Peter Ward, our CEO, we had appointed in Namibia, big fat guy, burly, fun, all the rest of it. He set up this meeting way up in November in Damaraland. And we were going to go and meet the local chief. And we drove in there, it was stinking hot, 45 degrees. And we had agreed to meet under a particular tree. And all we saw on the way in was goats, not a single wildlife. But we came around the corner and saw one footprint of an elephant. Anyway, we got to this tree. It turned out to be one of these shepherd's trees. And Peter was much faster than me. And he quickly jumped into the shade. And he filled the entire shade. And we spent the whole morning waiting for the chief. And I was in the sun, schwitzing, trying to get out of there. Peter, let's go. He said, no, we've got to hang in. Eventually, the chief arrived on the Cape cart. And his wheels were like this, the axle was going like that. No cash, not a single person in his community had ever had a job. And we struck the deal then. This is the early 90s. And we said, okay, we'll bring tourists in here and we'll pay you for it. And as those partnerships, today in Namibia, 35% of Namibia is set aside with community conservancies, with the communities, the prime beneficiaries, with wildlife and tourism all linked together in various forms. And today there's more black rhinos running free and wild in community areas in Namibia than there are in national parks. And there's no poaching. And we learned these lessons. It's a partnership story. And those partnerships were so valuable because there wasn't a blueprint. We didn't know how to do it. And we kind of went into these negotiations with kind of understanding that it had to be a fair share. And if we could fair share, then there'd be plenty for everybody. And it was a remarkable business. And I ran it for 25 years, sold out in 2006. It went on to list on the Gaborones and Johannesburg stock exchanges, and it's still going today. It's a good company. But yeah, time to move on. And you came and said, Lekkerwater, natural selections, we kind of got into this business of conservation by accident. We all kind of done our own things, all my partners at Wilderness, and I went for a lunch with Dave van Smeerdijk and his wife, Jen. And we had kind of wondering what to do with our lives. And Dave said, I've got a share in one lodge in Botswana. And I said, I've got this community commitment down in the Wild Coast, which we had done. We'd started that in 2002. And now we're sitting in 2014. And I said, I've got this commitment we've got to deliver. And we decided, well, let's do a conservation business. And we had realized early on that the business of conservation through donations it's not sustainable. You know, we saw that in COVID. We saw that in 9/11, all these type of things. As soon as you have a crisis, if there's no business behind conservation, there's no funding. And as soon as you don't have funding, the projects die up. And then the community has been led down a particular golden path to find that there's nothing. And they become the antichrist of conservation. So we started a conservation business. And that's what I love talking to you. I listen to you and you talk about mining and all the rest of it. And I say, one of the greatest opportunities in Africa is a conservation business. So we started natural selection. We went to all our mates and we created a fund and we invested different lodges. We now control something like 1.5 million hectares of land. We've got 30 different lodges and each one is different. Each one is like, it's a partnership with different entrepreneurs. And we bought a chunk of their businesses and we took all the messy stuff that what original entrepreneurs don't like doing. You know, all the finances, all the accounts, all the reservations, and often the logistics. And we do all that and we leave the original entrepreneurs to do what they are best at. And it's been a remarkable business where suddenly we kind of got inspired by Patagonia. You've probably seen Patagonia on all these shirts and that. And they created 1% for the planet. And 1% of all their gross revenues go to good things. And we were thinking of joining the 1% for the planet. But then we said, we can't control it. So let's rather get our own fund. And we said we had to be 50% better than Patagonia. So we take 1.5% of our revenues and we put it into a foundation. And we've only been going officially for about 8 years. And we've already put something like 50 million rand directly into conservation before our shareholders have got a cent. But in the doing good, the value of our business has just gone through the roof. I mean, we don't have a single partner trying to exit. We keep getting partners saying, can I buy more shares? Can I buy that? And the business of conservation, if it's done right and it's done fair, is a remarkably profitable business. And the better you do, the better conservation comes. And I don't think we do enough of conservation business in Africa. We get the big corporates coming in. I mean, we've got controversy in the Masai Mara. We've got Ritz-Carlton coming in and developing on the most pristine part of the Masai Mara River where the crossings happen. And we've got all these big companies coming in, but they're not doing the business of conservation. And I think if everybody did the business of conservation, their own businesses would be so much better. And I think, you know, when I saw you doing all your talks about mining, I said, hey, you know, this is probably the greatest untapped asset in Africa. How do we get tourism? Now, remember in South Africa, something like 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 people in South Africa put food on their table directly because of tourism in its various forms, direct and indirect. I'm including the laundry, which happens for the hotels and stuff like that. But 1 in 6 and 1 in 7 South Africans puts food on their table every single day because of tourism. And we're only scratching the surface. You know, we talk about 2.5 million foreign tourists to South Africa. That's a fallacy because we don't have proper stats and we count on arrival and various things and we double count. So we got about 2 million foreign tourists coming to South Africa. And if you compare us to Africa, to Australia, you know, at 1995, we were kind of a little bit behind Australia. And since then, we've kind of grown a bit and then we've plateaued. Whereas Australia's now got 10 point something million foreign tourists. And we're sitting at 2. And what's Australia got? They got a rock, some nice food, a dying barrier reef, not much else. And we got all our color, our flavor, our everything. And we're still sitting at 2 million. And we've got to do something about this. And there's opportunities all over the place to really link business to conservation. And if you look at our private, our provincial parks, and I'm coming to Lekkavata where you went, you know that most of our provincial parks are broke. The fees must fall kind of eats into conservation budgets. And as soon as there's a crisis in Treasury, the conservation budgets don't get escalated or they get cut. And so we've got opportunities. We've got something like 50 provincial parks in South Africa. And just about every one of them is bust. The provincial parks don't have the budget. Most of their money goes on salaries. We work heavily in the Eastern Cape, and I think 80% of their budget goes to salaries. There's not enough money to go and do conservation work. And there's these opportunities to partner with the government sector and with communities. And I think the other day we saw Sandparks give out their latest figures. They now are turning over 4 billion rand. And something like 22% of their budget comes from government. The rest comes from partnerships, concessions, park fees, and all the rest of it. So there's massive opportunities.
Yeah. Colin, I think I've interviewed thousands of people. I don't think I've ever had anyone talking straight off for 14 minutes without letting me get a word in edgeways. No, it's fascinating. And you can see the passion come through. But let me conduct the interview, I think, rather than you tell us what you want to say. And I want to go back. I want to go back to when you sold Wilderness Safaris, because there you are. You had a coin toss. You got into perhaps the best way of living in the world, working with nature, as the big boss wanted us to do, I suppose, many years back. You build up this incredible business. It's done such a lot of good. It's heading for a listing, and you bail. What caused you to leave the great capitalistic goal and to decide to have another startup?
So, Alec, it was tricky. You know, that we didn't want to take on debt. So we brought in partners, and we also realized to control the quality in 7 countries couldn't be done on salary alone. So what we did is we made sure that the people who ran our businesses in Namibia and Malawi and all the rest of it, Botswana, Zimbabwe, every one of them had shares in the business. And most of them were younger. And we had this real big kind of push for a listing. So every board meeting, I'd sit down and say, guys, 3 rules. No talk about listing, no Mozambique, and no Zambia. That's it. And the reason for no Zambia, I mean, it's a tough business if you're a foreigner. It's great if you're a Zambian company and you've got a business in Lusaka. You know, it's got a 4-month high season and you've got 12 months of costs. So Zambia is very difficult if you're not a Zambian. Mozambique is just to try and deal in tourism in Mozambique is incredibly difficult. The people who have succeeded are on the islands, but the guys on the mainland, you know, so many people have gone into Mozambique. So I prefer to go and pay the $200 and somebody else must worry about the temperature of the beers and how well the prawns are cooked. And it's a great holiday destination, but as a business, it's really tough. And the listing, the problem we have is that you can run a perfect business, but if there's something happening in New York or wherever, 911, the Gulf, whatever it is, you'd suffer. So, and we have these extraordinary highs and these massive lows. So if you're going on the stock exchange, then you're kind of running the business for a 23-year-old guy who's writing for Financial Mail or whatever, who's got jobs. And you run the business for jobs, as opposed to, you know, like a company like Singita. They say, when they sit down and they go and do their planning, they say, what's going to be right for 100 years? We sit down in natural selection, we say, what's going to be right for a generation? But if you're on the stock exchange, the 23-year-old oak with jobs determines your business. So at Wilderness, I was so scared about listing and watching what happened on the list and this up and down. And you kind of go through, you know, if you're in the business of socks and you don't sell a sock today, you can sell it tomorrow. You know, once the bed night's gone, it's gone. And so we do go through these highs and lows in tourism. And I just didn't want to be part of a list where you're in a situation where you're worrying about what the analyst thinks as opposed to what's good for the business. And the successful company.
There should be many more CEOs should be thinking the same way. In fact, love him or hate him, but Donald Trump wants to change things in America from the quarterly reporting to half-yearly reporting, which we have in South Africa. But even as the point you make, even half-yearly reporting, that's not a long-term game. And I guess you are very much in the long-term game. And from certainly what I've seen up front from natural selections, from only the one visit that I've had, it does appear to be something where you are looking long into the future in everything you do.
Yeah, we've got to be profitable and we've got to have cash flow. So you quickly have to get your businesses and your occupancies up. Everything is hinging around occupancy and price. We've taken the decision at Natural Selection that our primary source of business is the travel trade. And the travel trade is kind of like, you know, this whole talk about disintermediation and all that before COVID, it was strong. There was a strong talk. But when COVID hit and you were stuck in Indonesia in some godforsaken little airport and you tried to get out and you phoned a call center and you couldn't get out and you were stuck on, and you slept on some bug infested floor somewhere. It wasn't fun. And yet the guests who traveled with the through the travel trade, all they did was phone up their tour operator and said, listen, I'm stuck here, get me out of here, get me home. And they got home. And the travel trade was entrenched into the business of tourism. And we've taken the view that it's here to stay. Obviously, we've got to all be in different markets, and in the South African market, for lack of art, and we obviously very strong in the South African market, and we always have South African prices. And it's the closer you go to departure, the cheaper it becomes. So we love the South African
business. Just say that again, because we've got a tribe at BizNews always looking for a deal. And you say South African prices. What exactly does that mean?
So often our SADC prices are 70 to 80% off the retail price. We can never make money from South Africans, but what we do is we fill the valleys and we fill the last minutes. So depending on when you travel, if you want to book far out, that bed could be filled by an international at often 4 or 5 times the price. But the closer you go to departure, the cheaper our prices come. And I say literally sometimes we're 70 to 80% off retail price because we love the South African business. It's last minute. It's in there. You know, the guides love hosting South Africans because you don't have to start. This is an impala. And there's, you know, you get into the birds and you get into the trees and, you know, it gives you a whole lot of difference. You expand your repertoire as a guide when you host South Africans. And generally they've been around and they're fun to have and all that type of stuff. So we love the internationals because they pay. I mean, when you build a lodge today, unless you just put up a little tiny kaya, at South African prices, we hardly cover the variable costs. We cover the variables and a little bit of fixed, but the international is where we make money. So those come first, and the closer you get to departure, the higher the discount.
How do you reach the international market?
Through the travel trade. So we take the view, there's 8 billion people on the planet, probably only at best 1.5 billion, which are potential customers. And the travel trade, they've got offices in around the world and they've got their customers. So we make it easy for the tour operators to book with us and they go and do the reach. So we deal with about 1,500 tour operators around the world. And they in turn, each have got their customers, travel agents, retailers, all the rest of it. And suddenly you get to 1.5 billion people quite easily. And off you go. And it's that type of thing. You know, and one of my greatest sort of disappointments of the Ramaphosa-Trump meeting is that we had an extraordinary opportunity and we did not take our opportunities. And, you know, one of the things that we are as South Africans, in fact, Southern Africans, but South Africa in particular, we are the world champions when it comes to repeat and referrals. So if Ramaphosa or Johann Rupert or whoever had been briefed and said, folks, you know, when Trump went off, hang on, Mr. Trump, we host 400,000 Americans every year and not one gets injured and they all go out and tell their friends. And that comes through the travel trade and it comes through to us. And if we'd done that to Trump and given him the real story and then how 1 in 6, 1 in 7 South Africans depends on tourism to put food on their plate, we would have diffused a lot of that nonsense. Instead, they focused on all the violence and stuff like that. But 400,000 Americans every single year come here and they have the best time and they go and tell their friends. And, you know, when we had a situation the other day with a group at one of our restaurants and the bill came and the guy took the bill and he said, now bring me the whole bill. And the waiter said, no, that is the whole bill. What? You know, we can't beat it. So we give incredible experiences. They go out and tell their mates and they're 400,000. In a couple of years' time, it'll be 500,000 and on we go.
So, and that's always the most powerful, isn't it? The word of mouth referrals.
Absolutely. Word of mouth and dealing with the travel trade. If you try and fight the travel trade and undercut them, oh my goodness, there's so many case studies on this that you'll just die. You know, if somebody contacts you direct, obviously you can deal with them, or you refer it back to the travel trade, whichever, you know, every company's got different policies. But, you know, that's an integral part of how these businesses need to survive.
Colin, what I found interesting about your story is so often I've seen founders, founder-driven or founder-led businesses being superior to professionally managed businesses. But more than that, when the founder has actually worked up from the bottom. And that has been your story. How long were you a guide for? In other words, actually stomping the felt.
I still do the odd trip. Not often. It's very selective. I started 77. And, you know, I was guiding all the way. But I was also, so Chris was our champion guide. And, I mean, the poor guy, we worked him so hard. It was crazy because he was so good and everybody wanted to go. I mean, we had the who's who of the world traveling with Chris. And then I was the huntlanger. I got all the overflow because I wasn't nearly as good as him and nearly as funny and all the rest of it. But you know, I kind of had to run the marketing side of the business, and Chris looked after the ground operations, and we grew and grew and grew. And I kind of got more into the paperwork. In fact, I've got a Dov Fedler cartoon behind me of a guy stuck behind his desk dreaming about the bush outside, and that was me. Well, I was highly envious of everybody getting out and about. But yeah, I was a guide for 20-something years. And then my guiding amounts every year sort of got fewer and fewer every year. But I still love taking people out now and then on trips, and we do all these wonderful explorations now and then and that type of stuff.
What sticks with you? Was there one particular story or maybe two that you can share with us from your guiding experiences?
No, we just, you know what? 911. I heard about 911 on Belduer Hall Golf Day at Woodmead. I think Joburg Country Club, one of those things. And we were at the farthest end. And at that stage, we'd worked out that every single American flight coming into Johannesburg at that stage, we had 60 to 70 people on that flight. And so I heard that there was a plane gone into the World Trade Center. And this rumor went around this big golf day. But for me, World Trade Center was out at Joburg. And I just thought, oh my goodness. And way back in the 80s, I had to go. There was a group of overlanders who were hijacked outside Wangi National Park. And you know, this is just post Zimbabwe independence. And there was all that. There were the rebels hiding out, and they were hiding out in Wangi. And this big truck got hauled out, and a whole lot of guys were killed. And I had to go in. And I remember opening the first rucksack and trying to find out whose it was. And there was this cassette on the top, Highway to Hell. And it was one of the most stressful things I've ever done. And then, so I'm now walking back, they cancel the golf day, and I'm walking back from the other side of Woodmead going to the clubhouse. And I keep thinking, my goodness, we've got 60 people who've gone into the World Trade Center in Joburg. And I just freaked because the stress which was coming. And then we got to the clubhouse, and there was the World Trade Center in New York going down. I mean, I was the one guy who was celebrating. It wasn't us. It was those kind of weird situations you find yourself in when you're running these kind of businesses, which you kind of, it's just not normal, but you kind of have to deal with these ups and downs. You know, there's, and I guess where that went, we had so much stress as a business. And what we did is we took all our senior guys and we all went up to Mana Pools because nobody was traveling. And we did a canoe trip, 8 of us, no TV, nothing like it, because we had just sat and watched the TV forever. And you get sucked into the negativity. And we said, bugger that. Off we went to Mana Pools. And for 4 days, we sat in that river and we just had nature around us. And we went through this healing. Nature was the greatest cathedral for us. And all of us, we just slowed down and we just kind of started to find ourselves. And then about halfway through the journey, we started to say, okay, now how are we going to get out of this situation? Nobody's traveling. Businesses are in shit. Cash flow is going to die. How are we going to get out of it? And we came through that process with nature doing the healing, with a business plan, which was remarkable, which got us through COVID, got us through 911. And it was those type of things where just being in nature kind of is just the most fantastic healer. And it was remarkable for us. And as a business, we grew considerably after 911 when everybody else was chugging along. But we had those kind of opportunities. So nature has always been the great leveler for us. And it kind of knocks us back into shape. If we misbehave, we get smacked. If we do good, we get more good for us.
You must see transformation in guests as well. Those who come out to your properties terribly stressed, especially if you are doing some of your guiding. And then by the time they leave, they're human beings again.
And dysfunctional families. Oh, my goodness. You see families coming from all the way around the world, all the money in their world. I mean, we've hosted, you can't believe who we've hosted, been the who's who. We had this, I was going to mention her name, but I won't. We had one of these fashion moguls arrive at Vic Falls once. Came off the plane screaming and shouting, because that's what she was used to. Screamed in through customs immigration. Got out to the parking lot in Vic Falls with our guy, this trolley in the bag, screaming. And we had to say, listen, pack your bags or behave. And she said, no, what do you mean I've got to pack my bags? I said, we're not hosting you. If you continue like this, we're not hosting you. Get back on the plane. Oh, and she turned around. And at the end of the trip, no cell phones or little need for cell phones. She phoned me afterwards, completely reformed person, just kind of got a grip on herself. And we've seen families who come, they're dysfunctional. And, you know, you see them in the restaurants all the time, little kids with these headphones are looking at bloody screens and all the rest of it. And there's none of that. And we deliberately make sure that there's no Wi-Fi in the dining areas and the lounge areas and that. So we normally have Wi-Fi in the bedrooms so people can catch up at nighttime or whatever. But in the main public areas and around the fire and all the rest of it, there's no Wi-Fi. And you suddenly find there's a shared experience or experiences during the day. And then the dysfunctional families start to find each other. And that remarkable kind of nature healing, finding and all the rest of it, it just brings families back together. And this is why we're seeing so many more families coming on safari. You know, getting multi-generations all the way from grannies to the snot gobblers at the bottom, all coming along and all having a great time and finding each other, finding themselves.
So where are your properties?
So we're the strongest in the Okavango. I mean, all of us, between the four of us founders, we've got something like 100 years of on the ground, and mainly in the Okavango. So that's the culture we understand the best. That's the systems. And so, I mean, we've got about 1.5 million hectares of land, which we manage. In different parts of Makhari Khari, we've got lodges in the Makhari Khari and in the Okavango Delta. Namibia, we're quite strong in Namibia, and we've got two in South Africa. You went to Lekavata, and we've got this project up the wild coast called Gwegwe in Kambati, which is kind of like a 22-year process to get this to fruition. And it's kind of one of our key projects because this is a land claim. 102 years ago, the ancestors of the people who own the land today were thrown off the land to make way for a leper colony, which was on Robben Island. And we know what happened in Robben Island. And they chose this chunk of land along the wild coast because it had the most benign climate. If you know, Karoo would be ideal for a leprosy colony and a hospital, but it's too hot in summer and too cold in winter. So they chose this chunk of the land, moved everybody off and dumped them inland. And in the new South Africa, if you were thrown off your land after 1913, you could have your land restituted. And this community could have moved their entire families, their goats, their livestock back into Mkombati Reserve. And they elected not to. And this is one of the poorest communities in South Africa. Even the chief doesn't have running water. And they elected to keep it for biodiversity conservation on the condition that they get the jobs, the training, and the money. So we structured the deal. They get 9% of turnover. We paid our first check. So we do a rental every month. And then once a year, we do 9% of our turnover. And a third of that goes to parks for their conservation work. There again, the conservation again, the business of conservation. And and two-thirds goes to the community. And they were expecting, we had the 2 weeks ago, we had the whole trust at Gwegwe. And we had this big Standard Bank kind of check printed, you know, one of these big ones you see at the sports. So they no longer have them because we didn't have checks anywhere. We had one printed and we wrote the number in there. And we had it all rolled up and we went around the trust and said, how much do you think this is going to be? And one guy was saying 20,000 rand. Another guy was saying 25. I think the highest got to 50. And in our first year of trading, remember, first years are normally dreadful. Our first year royalty payment over and above the jobs, the trading and all these other things, 477,000 rand. There were tears. And that kind of reinforced that their upliftment, and we made them promise, because one of the problems with trusts around Africa is the money goes to the big men and that you don't see it going down. And we said to them, you got to sleep on this tonight. We want to know. You're going to have caucus today. You're going to have to sleep on this tonight. And you're going to caucus again tomorrow morning. And you're going to tell us how you will spend the money. So I took the check away, put it under my arm and said, I'll see you tomorrow morning. And they elected to take that entire amount of money and spend it on 7 primary schools throughout their 7 administrative areas. And that's to uplift it and get proper blackboards and all the stuff they need. So it's kind of, that's the kind of relationship you want. And part of this thing, where we're going, is that we're going to double the size of Umkhambati if we continue on this path. And we're going to reintroduce white rhino. This will be a community-owned reserve, which has got white rhino. And to make that happen, we've got our own equivalent of the Black Mambas, with a highly successful anti-poaching team in the Kruger area, who've all women and have reduced poaching from catastrophic to zero. So we're being mentored by them, and we've got this process. But it comes back to, it's the business of conservation, and the two go hand in hand.
The Black Mambas, that sounds incredible. All women. Are they sharpshooters, or how do they get it right?
They're totally unarmed. And what they did is they went into their communities through their leadership structure, through the tribal leaders, and said, right, we need, I think they're up to something like 40 women now, but it started off small scale, and we need your most impoverished women. And these women were selected and trained. They go out unarmed, and the women have got much better sort of feelers into communities, and they know what's happening long before it happens. So, as you know, Kruger has gone through the most extraordinary poaching crisis, catastrophe. And in that whole area where the Black Mambas operate today, there is no rhino poaching. Why? Because there's now this message that, hang on, we're benefiting from rhinos. We're getting the jobs. We're getting the training. And we now also part of the security. And those rhinos became their animals. So the poaching's disappeared through complete nonviolence. And that's, we've sent a couple of our folks up to the Black Mambas, and we've been mentored by them. And so we've started the Green Griffins, which we've done the 2 first selection courses. And it's the most impoverished and the most abused women who make it through the process the best, because they have no other opportunity. In our area at Umkhambati, I mean, there's no jobs. So it was very easy to find women who were putting up their hands in, and they had to go and run the 4.6 kilometers and do all the press-ups and all this type of stuff. And that's the selection process. And we're about to do the final training, a 4-week training course, and then we deploy them. And coming back to the business of conservation, our first sponsor was 2 Ineos Grenadiers. How's that? Ineos Grenadiers saw the opportunity and said, right, I'm going to be part of this. We're still looking for a headline sponsor, hint, 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 hint out there for the Green Griffins. It'll be a phenomenal project to get behind. I mean, the PR that you can get there will be extraordinary. But yeah, we're doing it ourselves, and I'm sure in time we're going to get big backers to come in, as what's happened with the Black Mambas. You've got to prove yourself, and then the sponsors are out. So the Black Mambas have just increased their numbers through the roof. Such a wonderful success story.
The community that you deal with sounds very different to what we are used to in South Africa. We have this narrative of people just wanting to grab what they can and live for today, whereas the community that you're dealing with are very much living for tomorrow and looking into the future. What kind of leadership is there that's created this?
I don't think it's obviously there's strong leadership, but it's the promise of an opportunity. So the Black Mambas, here they've got behind this initiative because they're now getting the bulk of the jobs and all the rest. Our community is, they know full well that the opportunity, I mean, our first school, so we've raised the money with our, let's step back a bit. During COVID, everybody wanted a refund. And we refunded everybody's money, except we said there's a conservation portion, which we're not refunding. That, you know, we have to make sure that our reserves keep going. And it led to this extraordinary demand for transparency from the customers. They said, okay, I'm happy that you keep the conservation portion. But we never disclosed the conservation portion. We had just one amount. You know, we had X number of dollars for the accommodation per person per night. And that included the conservation portion. Coming through COVID, we've now separated out. So we have an accommodation portion and we have a what we call CCR, Community Conservation Reserve. And we have a conservation reserve portion. And that varies to where you are. And in our situation, you would have paid 300 Rand. If you'd been a foreigner, you would have paid 800 Rand. That 300, right now, we've got something like 24 alien vegetation clearers at Lekavata doing the work which parks should be doing, but they don't have the budget for. So we take that money. And what we've done is we separated out the conservation portion to the accommodation. And everybody wants a better deal on the accommodation. So our friends, yeah, I want the best deal. Nobody quivers about the conservation portion. And that's the interesting thing about human beings. We all want to do good. We want to see our monies go to the right places. But hell, we want the best deal on the accommodation. So we grind you down and we get the best prices and all the rest. And that's humans. But surprising you. So it took us about 2 years for ourselves to get it through our own company because all the marketing guys were saying, woo-woo. Now it's such a wonderful way that we can raise money. So we take 1.5%. We put that into the foundation. We've got this now CCR, which we do good in that area. So the combination makes it all happen. And people now are contributing to the cost of conservation and to the management. So out of that CCR, we and one of our guest donations, we're going to completely and utterly rebuild an entire primary school at Mkombati through these funds. It's going to be about 2.5 million rand. But we're going to do everything from the toilets, the water, the boreholes, all the rest of it through to the classrooms and an extra classroom, blackboards, windows, ceilings, the whole bank shoot. And that's the broad-based benefits. And that's one school out of many. So we're going to work through all the schools in that area. And with the broad-based support and with the money going into the Google, we've got a mobile clinic. We've got a third INEOS Grenadier coming, which we're going to convert into a mobile clinic, which is going to go and reach all the people who can't get to the clinics. And when you get broad-based support, then things happen. And then you get the benefits from conservation. So if I was the CEO of Sandparks right now, I would say there's an immediate 10% surcharge, and that's going to the communities. And we're going to do ordinary community structures, and we're going to do upliftment projects all the way along the Kruger boundary. And it's just 10%, but it makes a huge, I imagine 10% on 4 billion. What's that? 400 million a year. We could do so much. So the communities are alienated if they're not included in the business of conservation. When they're included in the boardroom, at genuine boardroom level, the communities are fine. And we in South Africa do not, we pay lip service in many areas. I mean, one of the things about rhino poaching, watch where rhino poaching is happening and where it's not happening. Where it's not happening, the community is brought in and they're already benefiting. So we have some outstanding examples in South Africa of when we include communities and we've got some disasters when they're not included. Obviously, there's also the other issues of policing and justice and the courts and stuff like that. That's also part of the problem. But when the community is genuinely included and they're brought into the boardroom, they are remarkably on site. So say, Sandparks, they could do amazing stuff along the edge of Kruger. I mean, the private sector is really doing. I mean, they've got all these cooking schools. You've got these outreach programs. You've got schools developments and all the rest of it. But the private sector can do so much. Kruger is the kind of the ultimate kind of brand and facility. And that should be leading the charge. And that, same with Adder and all these places, there should be 10% going straight to those type of structures. Then your communities are very much on side. And then they're in the business of conservation.
Colin, you've given us such an uplifting message. But your book that you co-authored called The Last Elephant doesn't give such certainly the title sends the opposite view. What's with that?
So we've just literally launched now The Last Lions, which is exactly the same. So these are two books which are Pan-African books. They're West Africa, North Africa, Central, South, East, and us. The problem in our world is that we are in silos. So the folks in West Africa sit in West Africa and they only think of West Africa. They don't see what's happening in East, Central, South, And the same with lions. We don't see and we don't learn from the good. I mean, South Africa, take lions. We have superb examples of how lion conservation should happen. And we got the very worst, the total opposite, which is these canned lion facilities, which are dreadful, and there's just, it's appalling. So we kind of, we bipolar when it comes to lions. We've got 3,000 lions roaming free and wild. We've got all these private game reserves. Remember, the private game reserves were all agricultural land, which have now been converted into game reserves. I mean, you mentioned Adrian Gard, Shamwari, Kwandri, or you go to Pinda and you go up to the Waterberg with all the Velgefondes and the Marikalas. You've got Madikwe, you've got Pilanes. These are all farmlands which have been converted. So we've got the best rewilding examples, and we've learned how to manipulate the genes so we don't get genetic stagnation. And we have these extraordinary vets and wildlife managers who can move the genetics around and make it work. But on the other side, we've got this bipolar situation where we run this damn canned lion hunting industry, which does brand South Africa the most extraordinary damage overseas. I mean, you see these newspaper articles which come up about South Africa. And if you look at that, you say, do you want to go to Thailand, Australia, or to South Africa? You don't want to go to South Africa when you read that. So we got to, so that elephant book, for instance, no names mentioned, but there's a bit of an elephant crisis in Madikwe. But one of the senior guys in Madikwe phoned me up when we did that elephant book, and he said, you know, I didn't know we had contraception. And in that book, we got a whole chapter on contraception, and the contraception skills in South Africa are off the chart. And it used to be where you fiddled with the hormones of the elephants, and now it's not. You've got a proper process where contraception does work. We've got solutions to the elephant things. But the boss, or one of the bosses, no name mentioned, of Madikwe had no clue. This is going, we published that in 2019. 2019 had no clue that we had contraceptives. So that book was there to help people to get out of their silos and start to commune and learn what was good over there is not necessarily good over here, and take the good things from here and apply it there and vice versa. And that was the object. And the same with the lion story. The lion story is exactly that. And the greatest lesson we can do for South Africa into Africa is this rewilding story. My goodness, we are world champions.
And you're a world champion, it seems, at communication and at sharing the knowledge that you have, the wisdom that you have. So what would you say to your 20-year-old self? What would you, how would you advise the young Colin Bell if you could go back in a time machine today?
Flick a coin and go to Namibia as a geologist.
Go and
one
find
thing about
copper.
The tourism industry, Alec, is that it's 24 hours. You get phone calls in the middle of the night. Mrs. Schwartz stuck somewhere. No, it's, I think, just accelerated. You know, we were very cautious. We didn't have the cash, so we didn't fully understand the opportunities. Wow. If we knew what we knew today and we applied it to that era with a much smaller global population, a much smaller African population, oh my goodness. And especially in places like East Africa, where you've got, remember, the East African parks were set aside in the dry season months because they had those crappy little Series 1 and 2 Land Rovers. They couldn't get in the wet season, so they only got in the dry season. So those parks were set aside in the dry season. But when the wet season came, all the animals moved around. And so in those days, there was between 0 and 1 person per square kilometer. Today, there's between 25 and 50 people per square kilometer right on the park's boundary. And all of those have got goats, cattle, and all the rest of it. So the wildlife conflict today throughout most of Africa is extraordinary, brought on by human pressure around our provincial, our parks. And so I would say that if we could understand where Africa could have done, and we set up the community structures much earlier and brought them into the boardroom much earlier, Africa would be a very different story now. And I think that, you know, the problem we've got right now as well, Alec, is that the tourism industry is so efficient. So you can be in Paris, London, Sydney, Beijing, and 24 hours later, you're flying and you're in the Garden of Eden and you're watching paradise. And then you've flown to the next area and you're in paradise. And you on you go, and you don't realize there's a crisis. So when you and I were born, there were 450,000 lions. Today, there are 23, 24,000 wild lions. There's a 95% drop-off in our lifetime because at 20, we didn't know what was coming. And if we could stop that arrest, the problem we've got right now, what are we going to hand to our great-grandkids unless we all wake up? Guys, we've got to do this thing now. We want more people to get into the business of tourism, but the conservation side of tourism. And we do need to really bring our communities in. And I think that we kind of pioneered by accident. There wasn't a blueprint. There wasn't a book we could go to and say, right, let's go and do this. And if we could learn, if we can take that back to when we were 20 and really apply that with energy and with scale, yeah, I think we wouldn't have had a 95% drop-off for lions in my lifetime.
Colin, you've had two startups. Wilderness Safaris, as you say, is still going strong, and now Natural Selections, which is gathering more and more momentum. Is there any unfinished business for you?
Well, the unfinished business is Umkombati for me. You know, we've got our management of the 1.5 million hectares we run really well under control. We've taken a whole lot of marginal land and we've made it prime, and we've got good people in place. We employ something like 1,300 people now, and 99% of them come from rural areas. From, you know, folks, we take folks in from little rural villages where they have no running water and no electricity, and within 2 years they're running computers and, you know, dining with the who's who of the world. So that's kind of working well. I've got a slightly different job. I've got to make sure that Umkombati works, and I'll come back to that. And we also got a project in Angola to try and create a role model for the Angolan government to show that nature-based tourism is a really great investment for the future. You know, the Angolan government's focusing all about oil, but the headwaters for the Okavango Delta are in Angola. And unless we do something quick in Angola to protect the Okavango Delta, it could be in dire straits. And we've got the Chinese coming in at great numbers. We've got all the different folks pillaging and raping because the Angolan government has no clue as to the value of nature-based tourism. And so we've got a project there. We've applied for a 250,000 hectare chunk of land to do exactly what we've done in Botswana and to make that into a viable, thriving economy. So that's one. And that's a big one for us. You know, I think every company's got to have its BHAGs, you know, the big, hairy, audacious goals. That's one of our natural selection BHAGs. For me, I've got to get this project right at Gwegwe. You were at Lekavata. And now Lekavata and Dahoop is one of the most sustainable provincial reserves in South Africa because Cape Nature does a good job. And they, even though they don't have enough funds, they've got the partnership. There's ourselves, there's Marukuru and the Dahoop Collection, mainly the Dahoop Collection. They've got a lot of beds. And we all pay this 8% of our revenue to Cape Nature and all the rest of it. We got our quarterly meeting tomorrow. And it works. This partnership does work. But when you leave the Western Cape and you go and deal with other provincial parks, we're in dire trouble. And I think there's something like 50 plus provincial parks in South Africa. And most of those are either paper parks or they're in dire, dire straits. Umkombati is the one park, provincial park in South Africa, which is community owned. It's got government, it's got Eastern Cape Parks doing the actual conservation work, and it's got private sector and ourselves. And it's that blend of government, private sector, and the communities which have to come together, and we've come together remarkably well so far. But it's early days. We've only been open a year, and I have to make that work. We have to make sure that we can double the size of the park. And this is, you know, Alec, you're probably on the business side. This is not really business, but the hotspot theory is key to this whole story of biodiversity. And the hotspot theory is if we go and very selectively go and choose the right 5 to 7% of the planet, we can conserve 80% of the species. And one of the biodiversity hotspots is around Umkombati. It's called the Pondo Center of Endemism. We've got 2,200 species, of which 200 are found nowhere else. There's one tree called a Raspalia, a Pondo ghost bush, where there's one tree, which is in a protected area, one. And we've now, one of our guides, found another one just outside the reserve. I mean, how we think rhinos are rare. We've got 23,000 rhinos on the planet. This is one tree. So we got this extraordinary area of biodiversity, and we have to protect it, and we have to double it. And then we've got similar areas all the way down the Pondo coast, the wild coast. And we're working with all the different things. And there's what they call the 9 polygons. And if we can make Umkombati work, and we can really make our community become the champions for conservation through the benefits they get financially and jobs, etc., then the other 8 polygons will start to happen. And that brings in carbon revenue back to business again. Carbon revenue is going to be crucial to preserving some of these areas. And, you know, companies like Volkswagen are going to continue to pump out carbon dioxide. And we've got the opportunity through additionality in Africa to go and make more land available for conservation. And by making more land, we are creating more oxygen into the atmosphere and taking more carbon out and storing in the soils. And that has to be the message. We've got to create more areas. And South Africa is the signatory to the Study 30 story. I don't think we'll reach it, but we've signed to create 30% of our environment set aside for conservation. And there's the opportunities. So my job really is to create the gold standard provincial park, linking communities, government structures in the private sector for biodiversity conservation is the ultimate thing. We're well on the way and we're doing well. But my biggest single problem, Eric, is that South Africans don't want to pay. You know, there's a whole lot of people who hike through the Wild Coast and we've been saying, just pay 300 Rand to a nonprofit, not to us, to a nonprofit. Do you think South Africans like paying? No, but I've been going here for 20 years for free. Why must I pay? Because actually, if we don't have cash, I think it was Johan Rupert who said something to the effect that, what did he say? He said, conservation without cash is a conversation. And we've got to do that. We've got to bring the cash to conservation so it doesn't become a conversation. And that's where I'm at. So we've got our own goals of natural selections. And obviously, we've got to have a good business. We really understand that if we have a good business, we can do a lot more. This 1.5% has been amazing. It's just, and everybody can do, you can do the 1% in your own home. Take 1% and do good stuff. You can take, like us, some companies do even more than that. And I think everybody can do their bit. If they do their bit, we can really have a future where our great-grandkids will enjoy what we've enjoyed.
Well, what a wonderful hour we spent with Colin Bell and the template that he has, which is communicate, let people understand, and do partnerships, public-private partnerships, not just government and the private sector, but communities as well, is something that surely could be replicated in other parts of the economy, the country. And in some senses, you get a feeling that some of the far-sighted politicians kind of get this. They get that the future isn't all about individualism and grabbing what you can for yourself, but rather working together for the future. I love that bit that he suggests we as South Africans don't like paying. Well, maybe it's just because we don't know yet. Well, after witnessing this conversation, you haven't got that excuse anymore. Colin Bell is the partner and co-founder of Natural Selections. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.